The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm gonna make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film.
We've put on our wigs, and I have my quills at the ready to take notes from the Emperor's three close advisors as we talk Amadeus this week on Zach on Film.
Hello there, Zach.
Hello, Steven.
Hey, you're going to get a musical lesson this week.
Good. I like music.
It's classical music.
I'm fine with that.
Kind of ties into last week's, I think they call old music from American Graffiti classical music these days. Classic, so what do you call classical music? Archaic music?
Super classic.
Super
Jurassic,
classic?
Jurassic?
Jurassic classic. There you go.
Yeah.
Amadeus. Oh, Amadeus.
Mozart puts on dinosaur hat.
Yeah.
Jurassic classic.
So give us a rundown from this 1984 movie.
All right.
Starring Tom Hulce and F. Murray Abraham. Many people know them as Otter and the Mandarin.
Yep. So what we have with Amadeus... is a very old composer man named Salieri.
Oh, I'm sorry. F. Murray Abraham didn't play.
Yeah, I don't.
The man did not.
No. I don't know what you're smoking. Probably a pickle. So he's recounting his life as he lived next to Mozart, watched Mozart grow up, kind of have all the fame and all the brilliance of being a music composer. And Salieri was jealous because he realized he could never be as divinely inspired as Mozart was with his music and his craft. And he's telling this all to a young priest who wants to have his confession because everyone believes Salieri killed Mozart.
Well, I don't think it's everyone believes that Salieri killed Mozart.
He starts
Salieri believes that he is responsible for Mozart's death.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And he tries to commit suicide.
Yes.
And that's why he's in the insane asylum.
Right.
And because he's going to die soon, he's trying to get his last rites.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, does he...
Last rites, but last confession.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if it's kind of confession, really, is it?
Yeah, because he comes in, he says, confess to me your sins so that you may be forgiven and enter the gates of heaven with God. And Salieri's like, I don't want to be around God. I despise God. And let me tell you why I despise God.
Well, okay, so...
And how I destroyed his greatest creation.
I was coming at the point of Catholic's last rite. Confession, that's not what Salieri was doing, was let me confess my sins.
Right,
it was more, let me tell you this story about how I suck.
How I smote God.
Yeah.
Right. It's more about expiation than it is about that other thing.
Mm-hmm.
So through Salieri's...
Sorry, I used a big word.
So through Salieri's flashbacks... Mm-hmm. We get to see Mozart's life, more importantly, his life in Vienna.
Yeah,
at the time when he did some of his greatest works and pieces, and follows him from his time in Vienna all the way through the creation of Requiem and the Magic Flute, which was Mozart's died soon after, didn't complete the Requiem. Although some people say that Salieri did end up writing some of that. That was a big bit of a conspiracy theory thing that goes around. Sometimes it pops up here now and then. Mm-hmm. Not that it was translated to him, but transcribed to him, but he attempted to finish it. And a lot of people apparently have attempted to try to finish the work, and I've not heard it all. My dad listens to it a lot, but I don't. So what do we learn about these characters?
We learn that Mozart has by far the greatest laugh in human history, is the best laugh. That's a laugh that makes you just smile mm-hmm. and say, yeah, everything's fine in the world because that guy's laughing.
Mm-hmm.
He's a genius, and he's the kind of genius that doesn't have to try, doesn't have to work at it at all. It's just like,
don't you hate those people?
Poof. Well, isn't that kind of the underlying tone of the story? Is like, should we hate those people,
mm-hmm.
or should mm-hmm. and should we hold on to that hate of, God dang it, how do those people get so much talent by doing nothing? They just have it. Or should we be okay with, holy crap, like that person just wrote an opera and without writing anything down, it's mm-hmm. all in his head. Should mm-hmm. should we celebrate that, or should we hate it because we try so hard ourselves to be a master craftsman of whatever we fancy ourselves at, while we can't possibly ever live up to someone who has that natural talent?
You know, it's really funny that, you know, Salieri decides at a young age that, you know, he's going to give his chastity. He's going to be pure of heart and not sleep around or do anything wrong. He's going to be righteous, and he was going to do all these things if God will give him a gift. And mm-hmm. he has a gift, and you know, some people would say it's very mediocre, but, you know, at the time he's very popular. But then he breaks one of the commandments, essentially. He covets what his neighbor has and really wants everything that Mozart has. And when he can't have it, he plots this thing to bring him down.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I think that is kind of a reflection on today, where you find someone who has a talent, whatever that talent may be,
mm-hmm.
Baseball, basketball, musical composition, comedian, actor, actress, whatever. And everybody just bags on them
mm-hmm.
for the things that they have. Why are we, is it our ego that drives that, Rodrigo? Is it our jealous nature? Is it our lust to be and have what the Joneses have?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think humans kind of naturally seek status.
Mm-hmm.
And there's basically...
You think naturally?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely, 100%. I think people want status because status gives you security, right? If mm-hmm. people think you're awesome, they're less likely to try to kill you and take your stuff.
But that's not kind of what happens here, right?
Right. So there's two ways of gaining status. One of them is to be awesome,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is to take down the people who have higher status than
right.
you. So collectively, right. as humans, we frequently do that with the people who have the highest status,
mm-hmm.
Celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think like presidents and stuff, but no, celebrities. It really in
well,
our eyes have
you
like
know,
that.
John F. Kennedy mm-hmm. did a lot of fooling around.
Yeah.
But you didn't see that in the TMZ of the day, right? People were like, this is president. You
right.
respect the office of the president. You don't do anything to degrade the office of the president. He's the president. Now it's like, let's dig up all the filthy dirt that we can find on the president.
Sure.
And tear him down, discredit him, throw him aside, and make him look every bit of fool as, I don't know, pick somebody that they're making fun of this
Mozart.
Week. Mozart. Curse that guy. All of his brilliance.
Justin Bieber.
I'm glad he's dead. If he were alive today,
I think what it really comes down to,
he'd be a thousand years old.
If he were alive today, he'd be Justin Bieber. But there's a term in college football that you run into, and that term in the sports sort of thing is parity among the teams. Parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, not parody, which is, you know, when you make a triple X version of Amadeus. But parity indicates that everybody has kind of a roughly level playing field. And these, you know, cases like Mozart is the point where you realize we don't have a level playing field. We shouldn't expect a level playing field. And that is upsetting. You know, not to get political, but how many times do you hear people say, well, they shouldn't get any handouts. I didn't get any handouts getting where I am today. Or, mm-hmm. you know, why should this person get special treatment when I don't? And what it really breaks down to is, I think as people, we have an expectation that everyone thinks like we do and everyone shares some basic tenets of whatever we think. And sometimes we're surprised. And I think what you see, especially with, and I'll say it, I'll say poor Salieri, because this is really kind of, it's Mozart's story and Mozart dies and all, but Salieri is really tortured for decades over things that he may or may not have even done.
I would argue that this is Salieri's story.
Against,
I would say that this is very much Salieri's story, in the same way that Jesus Christ Superstar is Judas's story and JFK is that other guy's story.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
This is very much Salieri's story.
It's Jim's story.
Yep.
And this is something where Salieri has been placed at a point where, as one of the best, you know, regarded people doing what he does, as someone who is very, very highly regarded as a composer, as a person, as a thing, whatever you want to do, has to deal with the fact that there's this punk who's kind of head and shoulders above him. And there doesn't seem to be any reason why, and there doesn't seem to be any way to level that out. And that would be incredibly frustrating. I mean, I think we can all think of someone where you just look and you go, how did that schmuck end up doing better than me? It's a very universal phenomenon.
But why? But I guess I'm still, why the rabid attempt to tear people down? Maybe, I mean, and again, I only know things that we see in our internet age. You know, going back to when I was younger, you had the Entertainment Tonight, and that really wasn't gossipy gossip as much of it was insider entertainment news with the lifestyles of the rich and famous tacked onto that. But today it's like gossip. Look who got beat up in the elevator today and blah, 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 blah.
That's because there's that discourse has changed, but that doesn't mean that didn't used to happen.
No, and that's what I'm saying. I don't know what happened.
There's always been
this.
Tabloids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. Right.
You know, it's just nowadays you can watch tabloids on TV, just like you can watch, you know, classy entertainment news on TV. Mm-hmm.
So with Salieri,
I don't know that there's been any real change, though. I don't know.
So this
that,
is human nature.
I mean, if you look at this, this
I don't
is
think so.
To some degree, yeah. But I think everybody has had a person that they just they hate, they badmouth for no reason. I mean, if you say to me, "Well, Kim Kardashian said X," Kim Kardashian could be saying the wisest and most wonderful things on earth, and I would go, "Kim Kardashian." Look at
you don't despise Kim Kardashian with a passion, do you? I mean, you don't sit there and go, "I will do everything in my power to bring Kim Kardashian down. I will destroy her. I will leave her penniless.
I
will make her so wanting and so insane that she will die from exhaustion and have to be buried in a pauper's grave," which is what Salieri did.
Well,
he used his power.
First and foremost, this is not history. This is not a biography. This is historical fiction.
Right. But in the
story, this movie is not factually true. So, yes, in the story.
No one's saying it's factually true. I don't think you have the power to bring Kim Kardashian down either. I'm just saying. Do you hate her and despise her?
Now he's going to do it, and it's going to be your fault, Steve. Matthew's going to destroy Kim Kardashian, and then Kanye is going to come after you for putting the idea in his head.
And you will watch his child. Or you will ride on a motorcycle with him through a green screen.
Well, if you really want to go into it, here's the deal. In the 18th century, in the year 1791, we referred to Kennedy. Kennedy was 1965, let's say 50 odd years ago. 50 years ago, when John F. Kennedy was president, there were rules of polite discourse. Mm-hmm. Those rules are not the same rules now. There were things that you didn't do in 1961 and 1962 because they weren't right. They weren't moral. They weren't correct. Now, bearing in mind that some of the things you quote unquote don't do because they're not right are not be male, not be Caucasian, not be, you know, well regarded in terms of your money. But if you go back even further to 1791, when we say, 50 years ago, this didn't happen, 300 years ago, there was even more emphasis on what you did in polite company and what you didn't do and what you would never say. And the things that, you know, if you went out and your wig was not powdered correctly, you would be offending people. If you were to appear before the queen in improper dress, you could be punished and or killed for insulting her court.
And I that's mean, all it takes. I mean, Salieri does not have to go out and post posters up all around Vienna saying, you know, Mozart bad, Salieri good, who listen to my music, quaint, yay. He doesn't have to do that. He simply has to go to the king and say, hey, I hear Mozart is screwing around with his young students. I hear he's having improper with these young students, basically accusing him of being a molester, to the king. And the king doesn't go out and spread the word. He just simply says, we're going to pick someone else. Mm-hmm. Yet the word gets around very quickly, and Mozart's not able to get students. Mm-hmm. And with his nature of being very, likes to spend money, that gets him into a lot of problems. Whose fault is this, Zach? Whose fault that Mozart died? Is it Salieri's fault? Did he kill him, or did Mozart kill himself?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, because Salieri certainly plays off Mozart's own characteristics to create something beautiful and to imagine new crazy music and push music forward. So the question, I guess, was kind of be, would this have happened to Mozart anyways if Salieri hadn't kind of pushed him that direction? Would 3 years down the line Mozart keeled over from pushing himself too far?
Yeah.
Or
public drunkenness. Slipped on a rock.
Yeah, I mean, possibly.
Cracked his noggin open.
Or did Salieri just understand the nature of Mozart and just said, if I put this to him, he will do it? Or was he just speeding up Mozart's inevitable?
Yeah. So what do you think?
I don't know. It's interesting because Mozart seemed to want to do more enjoyable things, like he did the regular people opera.
Yeah.
He seemed to really enjoy that a lot, but then he kind of got pushed, do this Requiem crap.
And I think he would have still done it to himself, because
it's possible.
There's a scene, and we are watching the director's cut of Amadeus. It's the only one that's currently available. It's got about 20 minutes of stuff that's been added. There is a scene where he does actually go and have a student, a pupil. And he goes in there, and the mother and the father want to watch, and they bring their dogs in. The dogs are unruly, and the father is kind of unruly too. And Mozart's just offended, and he takes offense to the fact that they are not stopping everything that they're doing and focus on him and focus on the student-teacher relationship, and he gets offended and walks out. I think his attitude, at least the way it's portrayed by Tom Hulce, would have led Mozart down that eventual path, and that Salieri is just there giving him that nudge in that direction.
I think as far as that relationship goes, what the movie, I think, says in its negative space, kind of, So you have Salieri pushing Mozart, and Mozart not doing anything to push back. He just kind of rolls him along to his own doom, other than being massively talented.
Yes.
I think what the movie kind of secretly tells you is that had Salieri decided to help Mozart, they would have created, like, Mozart would have continued to create, like, mind-blowing music. Like, if at every point that Mozart had asked Salieri for help, he had actually helped him, this actually wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't have been pushed to the brink. He could have given him a loan, could have essentially become his own little patron, which he kind of did, just for the wrong reasons.
Right.
And essentially, by Salieri's own admission, again in the movie, you know, Mozart was an absolute genius. Like, he loved his music and hated him for it.
Yeah.
But if he had managed to see past that, Mozart would have survived, would have continued to make this basically angelic, divine music from Salieri's standpoint. But he chooses to instead mess with them, and Mozart dies and he ends up crazy.
So is this then, going back, Matthew, a morality play then, of instead of trying to tear down that which is maybe better than us, we need to embrace these people, because again, this is a morality play told from the viewpoint of Mozart, who people know and people have listened to and do recognize his work as that of a genius. And imagine what he could have done if he would have been able to live another 20 years. What if instead of pushing these people off the ledge, we take the Lindsay Lohans and we wrap the blanket around them and say, hey, let us help you, because we think that there's something there that can go better. And again, I'm using this as an extreme example here. I don't know Lindsay Lohan. I don't know what her problems is. Justin Bieber the same way. What if we had embraced Justin Bieber at the right time and said, hey man, let's get you on the right path, whatever that right path is, so that you can create for another 30 years or the, you know, whoever, pick a person, you know, is that what, is that ultimately what kind of a message we can get out of this? Or maybe that's a question for Zach, but I'll ask Matthew.
No, I think you've got a point, because when you look at Mozart throughout this film, he doesn't go to the point of urinating in a bucket, but he is petulant and he is flighty and he is, you know, self-aggrandizing and childish. And he goes through the phases that you go through, you know, at, I'm going to throw my story in here. At one point, I was told I was in the gifted program, that I was a smart kid. And I, you know, that turned me from a borderline nerd into a flat out douche for a year or three. And it's still something that I feel like, you know, I fight about now, that moment where you walk into a room and presume you're the smartest person there. I think that having, you know, especially in the case of Mozart and maybe Justin Bieber, being told that you're incredibly talented and that you're wonderful and you do these wonderful things kind of puts you in a mindset that everything that you do is wonderful. So if you look at Salieri, this movie is actually told from Salieri's mouth.
Right. We only have his story.
The way I read this, right, it's the flashback. Salieri blames himself for what happens. Salieri blames himself for, I think, destroying something that was better than him out of jealousy, out of, you know, a sense that he didn't deserve whatever he had, however you want to look at it. That notion of, how dare he say he speaks for anyone, you know, but I think that the movie that we see, at least from my reading of it, is tainted by that perspective, in that what we see is Salieri supporting his own expectation that Mozart would not have flipped out and gone over any particular edge without his intervention.
Well, I wonder then.
So, I mean, it is hard to say.
I wonder then, Zach, and this is part of the part that haunts Salieri and probably forces him to try to commit suicide, is especially when, after he slits his throat, he's being hauled through the streets of Vienna, and everywhere he goes, he's hearing Mozart's music being played. And this is, you know, 50 years, 30 years after his death. It's almost like you killed the guy too soon when he was at his most popular. And maybe if you would have just let him go on, he would have turned into something mediocre.
Sure. It's funny because we watched this today, and I saw on Twitter that actor Simon Pegg tweeted something along the lines of, all actors or all famous people want to die before their wax mold of themselves gets melted down into someone else. They don't want to see themselves lose their popularity or their relevance to culture. And I mean, that's certainly a thing that happens for a lot of people. I mean, we see with bands all the time, or they'll release a good album or have a good song.
Kurt Cobain, for example, you know, he died at a young age. Janis Joplin, dies at a young age, and they become legendary. But what if Jimi Hendrix had lived another 30 years and was 65 or 70? And you're just put out enough stuff that turned mediocre that, you know, you died at the height of your popularity.
Well, you never know. First off, it's a human life. So, it's worth it on that scale.
Right.
And second, sometimes people surprise you. Sometimes,
They get better
after. After playing the bad guy in Cliffhanger, John Lithgow comes back and has a great career in his 50s and then into his 60s and then continues to really just, you know, later in life. There's like nothing saying that somebody's heyday has to happen when they're young, even if they did. I mean, look at, I mean, Neil Patrick Harris, who thought that we were ever going to see him again after he disappeared after Doogie Howser.
Right.
And now he's having his time now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you just never know when somebody's going to come back and, you know, a child actor comes back as an adult, or somebody who started out acting as an adult, you know, comes back, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and all of a sudden are completely relevant again.
Yeah.
Look at Wilford Brimley. What's the first thing we know Wilford Brimley from?
Diabetes.
No, it's from The Thing. That's really the first thing. He's in his 50s in The Thing. He's been acting forever, but all of a sudden he had that run throughout the 80s where it's like, Wilford Brimley, diabetes. That is how people remember Wilford Brimley, as a crotchety man in his 60s with a big walrus mustache. And I think that that's kind of wonderful in a lot of ways. But I'm not sure where I started that sentence, so I'm not sure where it's going to end.
Well, I find it fascinating. This is something that I always find fascinating, because we look at a movie like Amadeus, which is a, you know, a fictional autobiography or an account of Mozart's life. And you're like, oh, yeah, that was such a long freaking time ago that Mozart was around. The colonies, Declaration of Independence was going on during Mozart's life. At the height of his popularity, we were still arguing over the first amendments to the Constitution. That kind of puts things in perspective, doesn't it? I mean, it's like Mozart isn't that far away.
Yeah, it's also great that somehow in a movie that takes place in Vienna entirely with European people, they found a way to involve the United States. It's like, okay, we want Americans to understand that America exists. During this movie.
But they really don't. You don't see Ben Franklin coming
through and
sitting down and watching Mozart play. Although, you know, with everything going on, there's a good chance that Franklin may have seen Mozart play. I don't know.
Yeah, get around.
I mean, he did get around in France, especially. France is close to Vienna.
And
who knows what kind of crazy. It's just that little bit of information where you put it into perspective. Here's the United States forming. Mozart is performing, and you know the Ottoman Empire is falling apart at this time. It's just like, wow, just everything that's happening in that time period.
Crazy.
Yeah. Did you like this story, Zach? You seem to come in with glazed eyes tonight.
I was never bored during this movie.
Oh, you were not bored, okay?
No.
Because that's one thing. It is a three-hour movie. It uses exclusively classical music, all of Mozart's.
Yeah.
And some Salieri.
Yeah. No, it was a enjoyable movie. I had some problems with it, but not from the story aspect. It was shots and stuff. But I really enjoyed it. I mean, I like the storytelling structure of the flashback thing. I think we see that every once in a while, and I think it works. It works really well here. And that the pace of the movie kept up, and you still got whole gamut of emotions throughout the film, but it didn't ever feel like it was bloated. That's not true. Sometimes it felt like this movie was bloated when they showed an opera for like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But that is kind of a thing. It's like, these people are making an opera, so we kind of have to show it, because it kind of plays into this whole idea of what they're doing and how it's important to the culture and to this relationship between these two guys to show the genius of Mozart and show how he's affecting, the emperor and all these, the people all around Vienna. And so once you kind of get into that mindset, it's fine. So the movie, because when I watch a movie this long, I think, did the movie need to be this long? That's what I felt when I watched Wolf of Wall Street, Lawrence of Arabia, movies like that. It's like, did the movie need to be this long? And So obviously we were watching the director's cut, so 20 minutes did get cut out.
Yeah, of the original theatrical release. Right.
And but the part that got added in was bits with Soliari and Mozart's wife.
Right.
Which I thought added a whole lot to Soliari's character, which was should have been in there the first time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this, the whole thing that's been added in is this scene where Salieri basically tells Mozart's wife, hey, you want Mozart to succeed, come back tomorrow night and you and I are going to get it on. And then I'll do whatever he wants. Basically, you have to become my whore and I'll fix your husband up.
Yeah.
And they come in and there's a little brief nude scene and gets interrupted and that's it. But it's an interesting moment of addition that you're right. Mm-hmm. Does change the relationship between the wife and the villain.
So, yeah.
Or perceived villain.
Yeah, sure. Because I think you watch any movie this long, I think there's always that tendency of, wow, didn't need to be that long until you start analyzing. Well, they kind of needed to put all of these long opera scenes in there and show how to play out because that's the story they're telling. It's the same thing with Wolf of Wall Street. I thought Wolf of Wall Street was bloated because everything in that movie was to the extreme of the characters and what they were doing was just insane. Mm-hmm. And so the movie needed to kind of reflect that and to be long and unnecessary, essentially.
Over the top and excessive. Yeah.
Right. And so so don't let 3 hours intimidate you. You will be engaged for 3 hours.
Do you like classical music? Did you like how the music selection that, I mean, Mozart composed over 600 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting a small sample of this in this movie. But does it strike you? Is it fitting?
Yeah. No, the music, the way they integrated music into the story, I thought was one of my favorite aspects because you'll see Soliari start composing when he's in his mental asylum. You hear the music rising and going with him, and they cut back into 50 years in the past or whatever. Or you'll see Mozart kind of humming a tune and as that last scene in the deathbed when him and Soliari are figuring out the rest of the Requiem. He's kind of just mumbling this thing, but then they bring in what it actually sounds like, and I thought that was really well to show what is a genius like this thinking in his mind and how does it sound in there and let us kind of grab on to part of that.
One of my favorite scenes of this movie, and I remember as a young kid and still stands out, is you see Mozart at the billiard table composing and you hear the music going over it and you're just like, oh, this is just, you know, the music. This is him writing. And then you see Stanzi, his wife, poke her head in and she's like, Mozart, Wolfie, Wolfie, Wolfie. And she's yelling and she's like really competing with the sound. And then finally she yells it loud enough to where Mozart snaps out of what he's doing and the music cuts off. And you suddenly realize that we were inside of his head listening to this sound. And it's so loud and overbearing that he has isolated out the rest of the world. And it's one of my favorite scenes, especially when she yells at him and he snaps out of it and the music ends instantly. And it's again, great mixing of music in this film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that the music really serves to move the story along, and you can say that's true of the music in any piece, right? But in this, the story is basically
a lot about the music.
The music is a central part of the story, and that's partially why Zach was saying you need those opera scenes, right? You need to see not just you need to kind of see that music. And in a lot of ways, the motifs that we see are also kind of repeated visually. There's kind of like that your singing glowing lady appears a lot. Of course, that like mysterious stranger slash spooky father figure.
Right.
You know, that all kind of works together, and they all kind of have their own musical cues, which you then hear represented after Mozart writes the pieces.
Matthew, are you a classical music person? Is this music something that you're into or like?
Well, it's not necessarily a like or dislike thing. I was in the orchestra for many years in high school and grade school. So I'm aware of it, and I appreciate it. It's not something that I necessarily seek out in most cases. But I can definitely deal with it. I know recently Widget had a thing where we went to a music identification competition. They played her 4 seconds of a classical composition, and she had to tell us what it was and who wrote it. And I knew a lot more there than I thought I did. But I think it's more of a cultural osmosis. It's kind of the way, you know, that I absorb, I don't know, Batman comics. I never actually go out of my way to go and find classical music, but it always seems to necessarily kind of find me once in a while.
Cool.
Let's give a shout out to our associate producers this episode of Zach on Film. They would be Justin LeBee, Kent Daw Daring Heinesen, Charnel Claire, Ejaz Faruqi, Taylor Forbes, Kayla Brown, Matt Verlinden, Ejaz Faruqi, again, high five to you, Derek Chin, Adam Mickelson, Nicole Gross, Chad Andrew Shuttleworth, Bao King, JP Horn, and Devin Pellick. Thank you for donating to the Major Spoilers Cause. You keep us going week after week after week, pumping out more content for you each and every day.
What do you think of the... What did you think of the cinematography on this? Because I've got a bit of an issue, and I haven't figured it out yet.
Uh-oh. I was not thrilled with it.
Why?
It was very similar throughout. It was all very kind of high key lighting with wide and medium shots.
Yeah, a lot of wide.
The entire movie.
Yeah, really. You had a wide shot,
else.
Or you had a medium shot. Mm-hmm. And everybody is framed in the exact middle of the frame, and it was like, what a boring composition.
Yeah. I think
even in conversations when people are getting hot, you don't have Salieri on the left side and Mozart or the priest or the king on the right side. You don't have that that stuff that we now know today. Miloš Forman knows this stuff. And I don't know. I was bothered by the fact that everything was centered composition.
Really, for me, I was really surprised. This is actually the first time I've seen this all the way through. And any stuff that I'd seen of it was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised. I felt kind of cheated in a way, because even though I enjoyed this movie, I felt that like the poster and like the cover of it, like, is really misleading, because I expected this like visual tour de force.
Yeah.
And it's basically an interview show.
Yeah, you're right. It is an interview show. Maybe that's why it's centered that way, because that's how I felt. It was just like, why is everything centered, and why is everything, this is boring. This is, and you're right, I probably at some point flashed interview or talk show or something like that. But there is some spectacle. I mean, they did get a shoot in Vienna, and they did get a shoot in the opera house that these works were originally performed in. I mean, there is some spectacular stuff going on from that point. Everybody's just centered, and I'm just like, well, that's boring.
But even those, a lot of the time, they're kind of just wide shots while everything's happening.
Even those,
they're a little bit low angle.
Maybe.
Like you're watching it from Salieri's point of view.
Maybe.
That's the only real justification that I can see, is that since this movie is told to you by Salieri, everything shot at exactly 5:7.
Yeah, maybe that could be it. But the other thing, too, that I was thinking of is this was originally a stage play.
Yeah, that's what I... Yeah.
And, you know, there's stuff that are... You know, there's staging, like when the emperor comes in to watch the play and you've got the Burgermeister and the French Fry Meister behind there, where they could have staged things a little bit differently and done some really cool depth stuff, but it's like, nope. Flat, everybody's spread out, everybody's even, king's in the center, everything that happens just happens immediately behind in the center. And then I thought, stage play.
Yeah, that's, and I think that's something that happens a lot. So, Les Mis came out a year and a half ago or something.
Right.
And a lot of people had issues with that because it was all a lot of tight shots and they wanted to see more of the spectacle, which coming out for me is like, we've been doing Les Mis on stage for a long time. If you want to see that, I mean, they do that. You can go watch that.
Right.
So if we're going to adapt it to a film, well, let's use film techniques and show the story from a couple different angles and get tied up on actors' faces like you can't in a stage play if you're sitting 30 rows back. You can't get that tight emotion of Russell Crowe's beautiful voice right up in your face. And so I kind of like that about Les Mis, is that they took a stage play and then threw some film flare in there and gave us a kind of a different look at it. And that, I mean, this movie came out in the 1984. Mm-hmm. And it felt like, besides like color and sound and everything, it felt like throw this in the 30s and it's kind of the same framing and cinematography you would almost see then.
It might be fridge brilliance, though. Because the whole point that we're supposed to take away from Salieri's story is that he is the patron saint of mediocrity. And what better way to show that than have his perspective be so boring and mediocre? I thought maybe they were making some sort of reference to, you know, musical composition where you have that particular... You have very codified rules in composition. And
see,
these are the things you're
that would, that would go against
that.
Because
that's
the thing, though, is
either.
That Mozart breaks the rules. Mm-hmm. So if that was the case, and that would have been a brilliant way of doing it, is all that, like, as soon as Mozart starts, Mozart starts composing, you have low angle shots, high, like super high angle shots, all this crazy stuff going on when he's going, and you can center it back up for Salieri or for any of the other guys to show that they're back in the center. Mm-hmm. But when Mozart is going crazy, he's still kind of going crazy on the Today Show.
Yeah. I like the idea that this is an interview show, and I like Matthew's thought that this is this mediocrity played out in Salieri's brain. And even though his story is fascinating, maybe it's still just average. Slightly better than average.
Maybe he's just
that's a good read.
I like the poster art. For this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's brilliant. Here you have the city of Vienna laid out where the story takes place. You don't spend any time of Mozart on the road or anything like that. You don't spend a lot of time with Salieri in Italy. I mean, you've got these, again, another brilliant scene in the movie. It's like, and then a miracle happened.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I'm sure my sons are thinking that exact same thing.
Oh, no.
But here you have the city of Vienna laid out before you, and then you have this menacing figure overshadowing the entire city. And we know that that overshadowing figure represents one of two things, either Mozart's father's influence on Mozart, or Salieri as this control figure who really is in control of Vienna during this time period. And then you get into the little bit up on his, on the hat, which is from, and I forget it. It may be Magic Flute. I don't remember which one it is, but this big woman in the circle, which from a distance looks like, you know, it's placed right there on that third eye, which there's a lot of talk about third eye and opening up your consciousness and being able to tap into your creativity and all this stuff. It also ties into a lot of Illuminati conspiracy type theory things, which, you know, there are some conspiracy theorists. Hi, Bruce. Who believe that Mozart was killed because he was giving away all the secrets to the Freemasons in the Magic Flute. So from that standpoint, this is a brilliant, menacing poster that just kind of creeps me out every time I see it, just both in its brilliance of design, but also this creepiness. And if you watch, and I started to, towards the end, started to watch, how many times does the eye appear in the movie? There is a shot in Magic Flute where it does, but it's like, well, that's kind of the point of it anyway.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Matthew? Sorry.
I always thought when I saw this, you know, looking at the poster, I thought that the face on the poster looked like the Joker, and that Amadeus was going to come in like Batman, see, and fight this masked evil bad guy. Now, to keep in mind, in 1984, I was 13 years old, so I should be at least vaguely forgiven for being this person. But looking at that, and I'm like, oh, so he's the villain, and then Amadeus is going to be all like, yeah, now I should use music to punch you or something. So I love the poster. That's kind of cool.
Really, though, it's the other way around, because Amadeus is kind of the Joker.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you consider his laugh. Mm-hmm. And Salieri sees himself as the rightful person who should be in charge here. And he also tragically lost his father. So.
And we never see what happened to the mother, although that's not really relevant to this story.
Not really.
You can go over to Wikipedia. There's a
she
great.
She was shot by Joe Chill.
He was shot by the Burgermeister in Dark Alley. There is an entry over at Wikipedia called Mozart and Freemasonry. And you can read about the Masonic ideology and Masonic music and the list of Mozart's Masonic compositions. And read into that craziness if you want.
Here, I have a question I just thought of.
Go ahead.
Do you think Soliari was happier after Mozart died or when he was getting to transcribe the genius onto sheet?
I think that scene is like the happiest that we see Salieri, and why he has that regret afterwards is because for a moment he gets to touch it and he gets to participate because he starts listening to him as he's transcribing it and he starts anticipating it. He's like, Mozart's like, okay, blah, 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 blah. He's like, oh, that's brilliant. Then you go like, blah, 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 blah. And Mozart is like, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So like, for that brief shining moment.
Yeah. Gets to be in Mozart's brain. He gets to touch that light divine, right?
And
right. For a second.
And if he had not died, going back to let's support the patron, Salieri might have, and maybe that's the point of that scene, is comes to the realization that I should have been supporting this guy all along. We could have been working together.
Yeah, could have collaborated.
I could have looked into the eye of God. I could have tapped into this and maybe improved myself. And so after Mozart dies, I think it kills him more because now he's haunted every day with hearing Mozart music and everybody knows him. And he even comes in again, another brilliant scene in the movie where the priest first comes in. He goes, oh, do you know this song? And he plays this. He goes, I wrote that. It was very popular. How about this song? And he's like, priest is like, no, I'm sorry. I don't know that. He goes, oh, you know, I perform this for the queens and kings of Europe. And he's like, ah, how about this one? And he dun, 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 dun. And priest's like, oh, yes, wonderful. He goes, that's Mozart.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that kills him the most is that he missed that chance to touch and be part of.
Well, who is it? Ebert, I read, said the Salieri's demon was being able to understand genius when he heard it, but not being able to replicate it by himself.
I think that frustrates a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I do.
There's a, there's kind of a, I try not to let the anger side of it, overpower me, but there is like there's that angry excitement when somebody somebody does really good, something really good, especially in your field. Like I don't know, I guess for me, like if I ever see like a really brilliant edit on a show, and I'm like, how did I not think to do that? That is amazing. You know, like basically,
now you
I just
know what it's like to be a part of Critical Hit. That's what we're all doing is we're sitting there going, damn it. Why did, how did I not do that?
Oh, well, thanks. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's a lot of stuff, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff like watching the first season of Legend of Korra where I just wanted to fight my TV. There's just, you know, because in that,
but
in
it
that,
was not Rodrigo who was laughing at me.
Yeah, exactly.
It was God.
It is that sort of thing. So, you know, I think everybody has those moments. And sort of as a person, as a real life person, it's important to kind of focus on the excitement side of it and the positive side of it rather than really getting upset about, you know, the fact that you didn't think of something, because there's going to be more things that you didn't think of in your life than things that you thought of.
And I think that's one of the good things about having Zach in the show, because he is opening his mind to all of these things. And hopefully he's sitting there and going, oh, what a brilliant piece where Salieri's narrating this the first time he looks upon Mozart's work and he hears the oboe and then the clarinet and then high above you hear this flute. And hopefully that's something that triggers in Zach. Oh, why didn't I do that? Oh, I can do that. Or what if I do this? And I don't know.
If you want to get meta about it. In this very show, every once in a while, Zach says, oh, here's what I noticed. And the three of us are like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we totally didn't catch that.
And then we pants him as he walks out the door and shove him in front
and
of
him. And then we're like, I will make it my mission in life to destroy Zach. Oh, wait, no, that
but
takes
instead,
too much work.
But instead, we lift Zach up upon a pedestal and give him a podcast and say, Zach, go out and create great things. Just like we have a bunch of brilliant people on these podcasts. I mean, it's great to have all three of you here on Zach on Film. It's great to have everyone who works at our website, majorspoilers.com. And listeners, if you haven't checked that out, and I know that there's a lot of you who haven't heard our other shows or seen our other websites and other productions that we do, and maybe you only come to it in this episode, but I'm literally surrounded by brilliant people, and it makes my life seem more rich and fulfilling to have conversations with people who are smart, who have interesting things to say. I wish every day were filled that with those kind of people. And I think that hopefully shows like this entertain you and give you some happiness, some joy, some moment where you can say, hey, this is my part of being in and being part of the fun group of people. And we're glad that people like this show. We're glad that people comment on this show. You know, it's great. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I'm happy. I'm just rambling on there, but
good. I'm glad you're happy.
I got a bit of an upset
was
stomach.
Was anybody else distracted by Emperor Sriracha Ed Rooney?
Well, especially, well, you know what he's been accused of?
Who has?
Ed Rooney, the Emperor.
Oh.
Jeffrey Jones.
Yeah, he's been, what is it, child pornography or something? I forget what it was.
That's not good.
Ooh.
No, and so it's really kind of creepy to see him.
But he's in 1,000 things.
I know.
He was in every movie from like 1984 through probably 2000.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very popular.
He's in Howard the Duck. Who's Harry Crumb?
He was in The Pest.
He's in everything. He was in Ed Wood.
Yeah.
He was in The Pest. He was in Houseguest.
Yep. He was in Eek the Cat.
What was that one with the guy? Oh, that's true.
Yeah, he was arrested for possession.
You remember Transylvania 6-5000?
No bueno.
Oh. Yeah. Kind of sad. Because he was. I loved him as the... I mean, if you compare him from Ed Rooney to what he is in The Emperor, it's just...
funny when he does that.
Oh, yeah. Well, what does it say? Is like, well, there you have it.
Yeah. Well, there it is.
What? Yep.
And his little, Yeah.
Yeah. He does a great job. And that's a whole nother discussion, right? And especially if you listen to the Major Spoilers podcast, we've talked about that stuff. It's like, where do you draw the line when you know somebody's personal life? How do you approach, you know, their work or something? Yeah. Can you still appreciate it? Knowing that, you know, there are issues. And again, that's a discussion that we probably don't want to get into.
Right. Not here, now. But I mean, I would point people to, I mean, we've talked about it multiple times on the Major Spoilers podcast, but I get into it with a university assistant dean in an episode of the Major Spoilers podcast called Lovecraft and the Sublime, where we talk about Lovecraft's extreme racism and how do we justify still being able to appreciate his work. And I think that what Dr. Brad Will provides in that discussion kind of summarizes everything. So I would point people to that particular episode where it kind of gets hashed out there. So go check that out. Zach, what did you learn from this movie, this Amadeus, this Mozart, this masterpiece, won a bamillion Academy Awards?
I learned that if you're not going to do anything interesting with your camera, you better put something interesting in front of the camera. Because, geez, this would have been boring if it wasn't for all the cool wigs and clothes and music.
See that thing about brilliance from Zach? You're right, Zach. That's a good thing. If you're not going to do anything interesting with your camera, do something interesting in front of the camera.
It's like Kevin Smith's motto for like the first 5 movies he made.
Is that really his motto?
Well, I mean,
or you,
I mean,
just
look
come
at
up
it.
With
I mean,
that
no, I'm just coming
yourself.
Up with it. I mean, he didn't do anything with the camera. He just makes people say funny things and have interesting characters.
Okay.
So that I mean, it works. So.
Yeah, anything else you want to add?
I just think the integration of the music and the score and the people's minds and stuff was just brilliant.
I think Zach has really come a long way. I mean, if you go back to the very first episodes when this was still part of the Major Spoilers podcast, and no offense, Zach.
No,
I mean,
no,
I'm using the
taken.
Word ignorant in a literal sense,
no,
is
I'm
that
fine.
You were ignorant of many, many things related to film and narrative and production and craft. Mm-hmm. And look how far Zach has come.
And, you know, film analysis is its own discipline. You have to start thinking about movies differently in order to do it. And we really sometimes probably faster than he was ready. Yeah. We pushed him along to kind of do this because we also had to make a show.
Because I cracked the whip all the time.
Come on, Zach.
It's that big figure dressed in black handing me money every week saying,
exactly.
Is it finished yet?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, Zach has come a long way, but definitely... Nobody should expect anyone to just sit down and be able to analyze a film without either somebody showing you how or a lot of time spent thinking about film. And Zach hasn't had a lot of time to spend to think about film because he hasn't had a lot of time.
Right.
He's actually 8 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking today, I was like, I think I've watched more movies in the last year and a half than I probably have.
Do you feel like your life is better now? Do you think... is your life better? I mean, that's very subjective.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Do you think that you're a changed person after watching all of these films?
I think it's probably played a part into it. I think I can look at things or just works of art or just life in general and analyze things more deeply from different angles and aspects and kind of look outside of myself and look at situations that I'm in or just anything or draw meaning from a work or just appreciate it for how it was put together.
Have you started to find yourself applying things that you've seen into your work?
My work?
Yes.
That's hard.
That's the whole point of the part of the show is also get you to be a better filmmaker.
Well, I mean, you're talking about my job. I have.
Well, here's the thing, though. Some of these are, good principles in general. I mean, you probably are. I would be willing to bet that you probably have more dynamic framing in some of your work than Amadeus did, because definitely. I mean, my job is similar to yours. Mm. I spend a lot of time interviewing cows, and you just kind of have to like figure out different ways to frame a cow.
Yeah.
All right, Zach, great job. We'll talk more about this
in
the future.
Thank you very much. So let's wrap this up. Majorspoilers.com. Give your thoughts on the podcast posting page. While you're there, click on the Amazon.com link. Buy everything you want. Buy the entire website. Nothing will cost you any extra. But a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to keep us going week after week after week. Next week, we're heading back to Francis Ford Coppola as we talk to Godfather on Zach on Film.